figures are likely, and it should be a warmer day in the southeast of England, 14 to 15 degrees. Elsewhere, struggling to around 8 or 9. The weekend, though, hazy sunshine for most places. Temperatures widely into the mid to high teens. Some rain, though, flirting with western parts of Wales, southwest England and Northern Ireland, and eastern Scotland and northeast England struggling with some low cloud coming in from the North Sea.
Thanks, Darren. So now on BBC Radio 4, Simon Russell Beale continues reading Ben McIntyre's account of Kim Philby's devastating betrayal, A Spy Among Friends. Philby is now based in Beirut, where an odd encounter occurs in a hotel bar.
Good afternoon, Mr. Philby. I read your articles in The Observer and in The Economist. I find them very deep. I sought you out to ask you for the favor of your time for a conversation. My name is Petukov, from the Soviet trade mission. Here is my card.
After Harold Macmillan read a statement to the House of Commons, denying there was any evidence to support the allegation that Kim Philby was the Soviet spy ring's third man, Philby's return to British intelligence displayed the old boy network running at its smoothest. A word in an ear, a drink with one of the chaps at the club, and the machinery kicked in. In the summer of 1956, Philby's closest friend and colleague, Nicholas Elliott, asked David Astor, the editor of The Observer, for a favour. Would he take on Philby as a freelance correspondent in Beirut? The newspaper editor was happy to help. Astor contacted the editor of The Economist, and a deal was struck. They would share Philby's services. At the same time, Elliot arranged that Philby would resume working for MI6, no longer as a senior desk officer, but as an agent, gathering information for British intelligence. Beirut was exotic, tense, and dangerous. It was fertile ground for journalism in 1956, and an even better place for espionage. Philby began cultivating people who might prove useful as sources for both. Sam Brewer had first encountered Philby while covering the Spanish Civil War, so when the New York Times correspondent learned that his former colleague had arrived in Beirut, he told his wife Eleanor to keep an eye out for Philby. Eleanor Brewer was drinking with some friends at the St. George's Hotel when someone pointed out Kim Philby sitting at the bar.
What touched me first about Kim Philby was his loneliness. A certain old-fashioned reserve set him apart from the easy familiarity of the other journalists. He was then 44, of medium height, very lean, with a handsome, heavily lined face. His eyes were an intense blue. He had a gift of such intimacy that I found myself talking freely to him.
Sam Brewer enjoyed discussing Middle Eastern politics with Philby. Philby enjoyed sleeping with his wife. Philby's Beirut habits were regular. At midday, he would repair to the Normandy Hotel to down his first drink of the day. Vodka with V8 vegetable juice, open his post, and read the newspapers. One afternoon, a chunky young man in his 30s, evidently a foreigner, approached Philby at his corner table and presented him with his card. Petukov, Soviet trade mission.
Mr. Philby, I would very much like to talk with you. I am particularly interested in the prospects for a common market of the Arab countries.
Philby invited Petukov to tea at his flat the following afternoon. There, the ground rules were established. If Philby wanted a meeting, he would stand on his balcony holding a newspaper at a given hour. If he needed to see Petukov urgently, he would be holding a book. Philby was told that his first priority was to ascertain the intentions of the United States and British governments in the area. He happily set to work. In the autumn of 1956, Eleanor Brewer told her husband that she was leaving him. She returned to Seattle, telling Philby she would get a Mexican divorce. The only remaining obstacle was back in England, Mrs. Aileen Philby. She was virtually penniless, deeply unhappy, and usually drunk. She spent longer and longer periods in psychiatric hospitals. On the 12th of December 1957, Aileen Philby was discovered dead in her bedroom. Friends believed she had killed herself with drink and pills. The coroner ruled she had died from heart failure, tuberculosis, and a respiratory infection. She was 47. Kim Philby and Eleanor Brewer were married in January 1959, just over a year after Aileen's death. Back in Beirut, the newlyweds moved into a fifth-floor flat on the Rue Cantari, with a large balcony overlooking the mountains and sea. And so began a period of domestic harmony, unchallenging journalism, and discreet international espionage. Whatever information of value he gleaned was handed over to Paul Paulson, chief of the MI6 Beirut station. Then Philby passed the same information to Petukhov of the KGB, with whatever additional intelligence might be helpful to the Soviet cause. On opposing sides of the Iron Curtain, opinion in intelligence circles was divided over Philby's usefulness. His KGB case officer, Yuri Modin, still monitoring Agent Stanley, was enthusiastic. Yet some in Moscow complained that Philby was simply peddling recycled journalism. Similar grumbling could be heard in London.
You could have read it all in The Economist last week. He's got a lot of it wrong as well. He's taking us to the cleaners.
In truth, Philby was going soft and drinking hard. Then Nicholas Elliott arrived in Beirut as the new station chief of MI6, and the wheel of their friendship turned again. Nick and Elizabeth Elliott moved into a flat not far from the Philbys. Elliott was as happy as he had ever been, and back in his element, in a foreign city seething with espionage possibilities, fighting communist aggression alongside his oldest friend and his most trusted colleague. The pace of Philby's intelligence gathering, hitherto leisurely, suddenly became frenetic as Elliott put him to work, sending him on trips, requesting reports which were then combed over in conversation. Eleanor Philby described these as their happiest years. But Philby's world of contented marriage and secret duplicity was falling apart, with two deaths, one defection, and the unmasking of a Soviet spy. Following Aileen's death came the death of Philby's father. In the summer of 1960, St. John Philby stopped off in Beirut to visit his son. Nicholas Elliott threw a lunch party for him.
St. John Philby left at tea time, had a nap, made a pass at the wife of a member of the embassy staff in a nightclub, had a heart attack, and died.
Philby admired and feared his father, whose domination, he felt, had caused his stammer. But they had grown closer in later life, and Kim seemed overwhelmed by his father's death. His moorings began to slip. Then early in 1961, a Polish spy defected in Berlin. Lieutenant Colonel Michael Goliniewski had been deputy head of military counterintelligence of the Polish Intelligence Service. Some of his intelligence was first-rate, including the revelation that a Soviet spy codenamed Lambda was operating within British intelligence. And he had proof. Copies of three MI6 documents that this spy had given to his Soviet handlers. By the spring of 1961, MI6 was 90% sure that Lambda was a young MI6 officer called George Blake. While stationed in Berlin, Blake had contacted the KGB and passed over reams of top-secret and highly damaging information, including details of numerous covert operations. He had betrayed an estimated 400 agents, sending an untold number to their deaths. The news of Blake's arrest caused consternation. No one was more genuinely shocked and alarmed than Kim Philby. The two spies had never met, but Blake's capture suggested rightly that MI6 must have new sources within Soviet intelligence, and if one mole had been dug out, then Philby might well be next. After 3 days of interrogation by MI6 officers, Blake confessed, and less than a month later, he was in the dock at the Old Bailey. The verdict was never in doubt, but the sentence drew gasps from the court. 42 years imprisonment. It was the longest prison sentence ever handed down. Philby was stunned. He'd spied for longer than Blake at a far higher level and at greater human cost. If Philby were to be caught, he would never get out of prison. Philby was cracking up, partly through grief and partly through fear. In Helsinki, a senior Russian KGB officer had also defected to the West. Major Anatoly Golitsyn was a veteran of Soviet intelligence and had accumulated a vast trove of secrets. In the spring of 1962, the CIA allowed Golitsyn to travel to London to be interviewed by British intelligence. There, Golitsyn described how, in Moscow, he had heard tell of a very important spy network in the United Kingdom called the Ring of Five, a quintet of British spies who had met at university. That information alone was enough to revive the long-dormant investigation and put MI5's mole hunters firmly back on Philby's trail. The defection sent shockwaves through the KGB, and Yuri Modin, Philby's Soviet handler, was sent to Beirut to alert him that another well-informed defector was spilling secrets. The warning seems to have sent Philby into a tailspin of fear. In October 1962, Nicholas Elliott was offered a new post as the MI6 director for Africa, based in London. He would be leaving Beirut with regrets, not least over Philby's deteriorated state. Peter Lunn would replace him as MI6 station chief. Before heading to Beirut, Lunn asked Dick White what, if anything, he should do about Kim Philby. White snapped,
"Of course he's a traitor. Just keep an eye on him. Let's wait and see what happens."
The denouement came not by way of new information from a fresh defector, as Philby feared, but through an old friend, recalling a 30-year-old conversation he had long forgotten. Flora Solomon had known Kim Philby since they were at Cambridge in the 1930s. She'd even introduced him to his wife, Aileen. A pillar of Anglo-Jewish society, Solomon was a committed Zionist. Every week she read The Observer, paying particular attention to coverage of the Middle East, and found herself becoming increasingly irritated by Kim Philby's articles. In August 1962, Flora Solomon visited Israel to attend the scientific conference. At a party, she encountered Victor, Lord Rothschild, who had headed MI5's sabotage and explosive section during the war. Their conversation naturally drifted towards their mutual acquaintance.
"How is it the Observer uses a man like Kim Philby? Don't they know he's a communist? You must do something."
Rothschild was startled by the certainty in her voice. Solomon went on to describe how, back in 1935, Philby had once told her with pride that he was doing a very dangerous job for peace, and had attempted to enlist her as a Soviet spy. Victor Rothschild reported the conversation to MI5, sparking jubilation among the small group of officers still determined to bring Philby to justice. An intense debate now began over how to bring Philby to account. Even if Solomon could somehow be persuaded to testify, her evidence was hearsay. Philby would probably deny everything, and without a confession, there was no guarantee of a conviction. For Harold Macmillan, now Prime Minister, the issue was particularly sensitive. As Foreign Secretary, he had personally cleared Philby. Another espionage trial could bring down the Conservative government. MI6 sketched out a plan of action. Philby would be offered a way out: immunity from prosecution in return for a full confession and complete cooperation. Macmillan agreed to the plan, but insisted on total secrecy. From the moment Nicholas Elliott finally understood and accepted Philby's treachery, his world changed utterly. Inside, he was crushed, humiliated, enraged, and saddened. Philby had made a first-class fool of him and a mockery of their lifelong friendship. Elliott needed to know why. He demanded to be allowed to confront Philby himself. The idea appealed to Dick White. There was more chance that Philby could be persuaded to confess by an outraged sympathiser than by a stiff, lower-middle-class MI5 officer. It was agreed. Elliott arrived in Beirut on the 10th of January 1963. Only Station Chief Peter Lunn knew he was in the city. Lunn telephoned Philby and suggested a casual meeting over tea at his secretary's flat, where they could chat in private. Philby later told Eleanor,
"The minute that call came through, I knew the balloon was up."
At 4 o'clock on the 12th of January, Philby, a little unsteady on his feet, climbed the stairs and knocked on the apartment door. When it was opened by Nicholas Elliott, Philby seemed strangely unsurprised.
"I rather thought it would be you."
That's going to be some meeting, and we'll hear about it tomorrow. A Spy Among Friends was written by Ben McIntyre and read by Simon Russell Beale. This is BBC Radio 4. In a moment, the shipping bulletin, but first, something to be aware of. From this weekend and throughout the coming months, essential maintenance work is being undertaken to our long-wave Droitwich transmitter. This means some parts of the UK may not be able to hear the midday shipping forecast via long-wave. But it will be available live via the Radio 4 homepage. Click on Listen Live and search for Radio 4 Long Wave. This only affects the midday forecast. All other bulletins will be broadcast in all the usual places at all the usual times. So now to the latest shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday the 28th of March. There are warnings of gales in Trafalgar. The general synopsis at 1800, new low.